Welcome. This week's show with Jane Dunnewald is sponsored by Avlia Mediterranean Folk Embroidery. One of the fun things that designer Krista West has going on these days is her pomegranate collection. And she is now up to 6 designs. These are PDF downloads. And they're only $5. So $5 download. And there is no a model stitched for any of these. You just simply download the design. And then if you stitch it and send it to Krista West so that she can photograph it and release it as a kit or pattern, you'll get a $50 credit toward your next purchase. You also get your embroidery back, which is kind of a neat thing. But so you get a $5 download. You get to do the stitching and enjoy a really great design. And then if you send it in and let her photograph it and use it on the cover of a kit or pattern, $50 credit. So check those out. They're really great designs, all 6 of them, and you'll enjoy stitching them. And then also, Krista has 6 new designs. Miriam's Garden, which is a beautiful border design based on a 17th century Ionian Islands textile. Athenian Diamonds, which is a runner inspired by a vintage runner from Athens. Dorian Leaves, which is an interesting stylized leaf border worked in a modern colorway. Illyrian Scroll, I probably just butchered that, Illyrian Scroll, which is highly versatile design from a textile in Krista's private collection, and Agape Pouli, Greek for lovebird, which is a new little kit pattern featuring birds and stylized flowers. So 6 new designs, and on top of that, 6 pomegranate collection downloads. So check that all out, along with a growing collection of instructional videos at avlia.life. And thanks to Krista West and Avlia Mediterranean Folk Embroidery for sponsoring this show. And now we'll listen to our conversation with Jane Dunnewald. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Jane Dunnewald. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here with both of you.
Well, I'm telling you, we are anxious to talk to you.
There's yes. Talk about how much time do we have?
We need 3 hours.
Okay.
So we may take a bathroom break in the middle, but no. your heart. You don't classify well. You know, you're not a cross stitcher. You're not a needle pointer. Teacher, I mean, it's quite clear that teaching is your love, and as a former teacher, I'm all into that. But there's so many aspects to what you do that it's fun. And where Beth and I encountered you was from the EGA article about using vintage needlework to create art.
Mm-hmm.
And 'cause I remember when Beth sent that and she said, you got to see this. And, for lack of a better place, let's just start there. Talk about that whole thing, because you did it with quilts, you did it with needlework. How did that all come to be?
Well, I know we don't have 24 hours, so here's the short timeline, okay? So I was raised by women who did all kinds of creative textile things, and my grandmother used to tell me that my favorite thing when I was 5 was to go to her house and play with the pins and the buttons. And I would say, could I play with the pins and buttons? And she'd get out the button jar, and it kept me occupied for hours. So I have this whole needlework textile thing in my blood from an early age. And when I was in college, I embroidered, taught myself to embroider to pass the time when I didn't want to study. And then I was fortunate to go out to the East Coast to go to graduate school, which I did not do. Instead, I signed up to go out to Nantucket Island in order to study with Erica Wilson.
Oh, my.
So I studied with Erica Wilson for 2 weeks on Nantucket Island. I was totally a fish out of water, literally. I was the youngest person in the class by probably 20 years at least. But it was life-changing, and I totally flipped, and I loved embroidery, and I set out to learn every kind of embroidery that I could possibly do. So I preface talking about the Inspired by the Masters series because I want anyone who's listening to this to know I have a great deal of respect for what it takes in order to create art using needle and thread. And I designed needlepoint canvas as a freelancer when I first moved to San Antonio. I was all over the place. And so I do have, I'm an Aquarian and I have a huge rebel archetype. And I just set out to teach myself and learn to do everything that I wanted to do. So I studied black work and I took several courses at that time. EGA had, you know, their long distance learning program. And so I enrolled in a couple of those and still have the samples to show for it. Fast forward.
I'm gonna stop you right there because I got to back up. You went east to go to college and ended up with Erica Wilson. What did the parents have to say about that?
At that point, I was paying my own way, so it didn't really matter what
okay.
I thought. Did.
Okay, all right.
I have a BA in psychology and religion, and I was going to go to divinity school, and that's why I went out to Boston. And then I had a change of heart, realized I was doing that mainly because it would have pleased my father, who was a pastor. But needlework just totally grabbed me. And then when I saved all summer to go and study with Erica Wilson, I was waiting tables at the time. And that was life-changing. And then the most fabulous thing happened. The guy I had pursued, or, you know, it was kind of mutual, another reason to go to Boston, won a job with the San Antonio Symphony, and we moved to San Antonio. And the real highlight was then I was able to study with Willana Bristow. And so I studied with Willana Bristow, who just walked on water as far as I was concerned. And I loved her partly because she was in the big orange Erica Wilson book. And then there she was in San Antonio, Texas, and she invited me to go to her house and visit her. And she gave me some good advice, and I proceeded to take a number of classes with her at the Southwest Craft Center. And so I learned applique, raw edged, and also turn needle and design and composition from Willana. And so that has to be mentioned as part of shaping who I am and what led to my appreciation for the kinds of pieces that I used in this series that we were really going to talk about.
We got you sidetracked.
Yeah. Well, you have to know that, really, because here. So I was collecting all kinds of vintage needlework, embroideries, crewel, anything I could find, needlepoint, and also quilted pieces, because I had been to a Matisse show and I loved color, and I was inspired to actually start thinking about making these still life pieces that would pay homage to the artists who had made the pieces that I was incorporating, because often when I was finding them, they were at thrift stores for almost no money. And I carried one piece up to the desk at a thrift store that was marked $25. And I said, do you suppose there's a discount on this today because everything household is on sale? And she said, do you think the person who made that would want you to have a discount? Idea of what I was going to do with it. And I'm like, whoa, hang on a minute. I'm happy to pay full price. I just always have to ask. It's my Midwestern roots. So I knew that there were people who would bristle if they didn't understand what my intention was. And my intention, which is I'm very proud of the 15 pieces in this particular series that was featured in the magazine, because it is it represents almost every kind of needlework, eagle lachkoi, all kinds of sort of odd things that fall under the same sort of heading of needlework. And I rescued a lot of them, and I revived some of them. And when I had to do, you know, a little operation and cut out the good parts, I could do it. But it all came together in a way that was really very satisfying and fun for me to do.
And in doing that, do you introduce your own needlework along the way as part of the thing, or were you just building this from the different pieces?
Well, you know, Gary, the main body of my professional career has been to teach surface design, which is dyeing and painting and screen printing and gold leaf. And, you know, I know how to do 50 things that are considered surface design that are basically wet techniques. So my process really incorporated an awful lot of those techniques as ways of bridging visually the pieces that I was rescuing and incorporating into a particular composition. But then the way I finished them, they were all mounted on silk noil that I painted and dyed and printed, etc. But then in addition to that, at the when they were getting close to being completed, I used an embellishing machine and I literally outlined most of the shapes and most of the elements that I had already fused and stitched onto the surface using either probably like a number 8 or number 10 pearl cotton sometimes, and sometimes silk thread about that same equivalent. And I would outline the piece and needle felt it down as I went in order sometimes to hide raw edges, quite frankly. But later, because I realized that then there was actually this stitched component that wasn't necessarily the equivalent of the stitching that was in some of the pieces, but it still brought stitching into the equation. Although I guess needle felting isn't truly stitching, the way I was doing it, it looked as though I had couched all of the threads that I added to the surface.
Wow, when you look at pictures, you don't realize how much went into those. Holy smokes.
Oh, yeah. They're very, very labor-intensive. And it took, I think, 2.5 years to do the whole series. Oof. And that was working a lot. And actually, I worked one night on the last bit of the needle felting to the point where I developed a cramp in my back. And at 2 a.m, my husband had to take me to the emergency room. So...
So did you dye any of the threads yourselves that you added to the surface of those pieces?
I did not, but I probably own every color of certain sizes of DMC pearl cotton. And I'm also a big fan of, my father said to me a long time ago, there's a reason we live in a democracy, Jane. And one of the reasons we live in a democracy is so I can pay other people who are dying. I do my own fabric, of course, but when it comes to thread, that's not really an area of interest for me. And so I have purchased threads that have been dyed by other artists. And I think that kind of network is an important thing to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Definitely. I was just curious because your surface design work is so striking. And then those pieces, what you did with the soy wax, the leaves and the colors in the background are just so striking. And I see that and I just want to go and grab a needle and thread and start hand stitching. It just, because that's my passion.
Right, right. And I do have students who make backgrounds, not like mine, of course, but use the soy wax crayons and the other things that I teach them how to use. And then they completely stitch over the whole thing. And it's just so incredible what people are doing. So I totally empathetic with your impulse to want to do that.
I have another question for you because I rescue old vintage pieces. But what do you do to get the smell out of some of them? Do you check that beforehand?
I guess I must check that in advance because I'm not absolutely, I know there are ways to rid pieces of mildew and whatever, but you know, a lot of the things, I realized that I needed so many pieces in order to be able to audition because you can have a handful of things that just stylistically, they're not going to work together at all. So one of the time consuming and more expensive parts of the process involved becoming very friendly with eBay and Etsy. And what I have found when I have bought things in that manner is that when they come to me, they may not be in pristine quality, but I never have ever bought anything that had an odor to it when I opened the package and took it out. And there were some things that already had a rubberized backing that I had never expected it to have, including some things I bought in thrift stores and took out of frames. And those I just had to abandon because there was no way to attach something like that to the surface. So I don't know whether, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on how to answer that question. I guess I just avoided it. And you know, maybe it's because some things were well preserved on the other end. And so by the time I got them, they were still in pretty good shape.
Right. It's just a question. I thought, I wonder how she deals with that issue of it because I've run into it, and and some of them are so beautiful you hate to just abandon them totally. But when the smell is so strong, sometimes I don't. I just like, okay, now what?
Yeah, it's more likely that would be true with quilt tops that I've bought. And I have had to wash quilt tops with, well, I use Synthrapol because that's what we use when we work with dyes. And I do live in Texas. So when I hang things out in the summertime, most mold wouldn't have a shot with the heavy sun and the heat that we've got here.
Right.
Take that.
Yeah.
Talk about that Southwest school. That plays a real integral role in what you do today and what you've done.
Yeah, and I was very fortunate. You know, I came to Texas with a, as I said, a degree in psychology and religion. I didn't have any art background to speak of that meant anything to anyone. And yet, Texas at that time was really, in the best possible sense of the word, still a pioneer sort of place. And I literally started with classes at the Southwest Craft Center in San Antonio, which was an Ursuline sisters convent originally that had fallen into disrepair, beautiful French provincial architecture, and a trio or a number of women with great intentions and deep pockets picked up this property on the San Antonio Riverwalk and started gradually to transform it. Now they even have a BA program there. They did not have that program when I was there, but they turned it into a community art school. And they had all the departments that you would anticipate, ceramics and weaving. And so that's where I started to study with Willana. And I studied with her until she stopped teaching there, which was 3 or 4 years. And then I got this hot idea that maybe they needed an artist in residence. So I went down and sort of, you know, in my nice, polite Midwestern way, badgered the director, and he gave who was the head of the weaving department and kind of an iconic weaver in the state of Texas. So I learned a lot from her, although I never have been interested in weaving. But because there was a gap, there weren't any painting or dyeing or stamping. There were no classes like that. So she encouraged me to develop a couple of short classes, and that's how I started teaching there. And then fast forward 4 years, and I'd been married, and my marriage had fallen apart, and I kept thinking, I've lived my life according to what other people thought I should do, and this obviously isn't working out. So I went back down to the craft center, and I went to the new director there, and I said, "Do you know about this thing called surface design? It's really popular. It's very hot." This was like 1989, and you need a department here, and I'm just the person to set it up for you. And he was skeptical, so I went back every week for 3 or 4, maybe 5 weeks. Finally, he said to me, "All right, I've had enough of you. I'll hire you. Here's where you hear the keys. It's a junk room right now. You clear it out and get it ready for classes on June 1st. This was March. So by gosh, I did. And I started, and I was teaching 3 classes the summer semester. And the first time I taught the surface design class, I had never taught it before. And we did things like marbling and dyeing. And I was setting up the marbling pan, and one of the students said to me, "Have you ever done this before?" And I said, "Well, of course I have." But I didn't tell her I had done it the night before. And then because of that, I started to say to my students, "Look, I don't know everything. I'll admit it. But I'm a quick study, and I know anybody who walks through the door here has knowledge to share. And so I want to encourage you to share what you know about anything that we're studying, because the knowledge base will grow for everybody that way," which took a lot of courage for me, being a firstborn and needing to admit that I did not know everything. But it set a tone of sharing and camaraderie in the department, which eventually, by the time I left 10 years later, there were 12 people teaching in the department as freelance instructors, and I was running a program that had grown obviously quite substantially. We had inherited the library from the National Standards Council, and so there were a lot of things that happened during that 10-year period of my being the director of that particular department, or the chair of that particular surface design department, that really taught me everything that I use today in terms of how I approach students and the sensitivity I try to feel for what they're feeling when they come into a situation that's new and intimidating, and how important it is to share and be open to other people's ideas. And that turned out to be a formula that worked really well for me starting in 1990.
Was that experience where you flipped the switch on to view yourself as a teacher?
Yeah.
I'm not talking about just someone who just does classes, but someone whose focus is education.
Well, yes and no, because I couldn't be as good a teacher as I've been. And I've worked very hard to be a good teacher. I couldn't have been that kind of teacher if I didn't love my art and need to be immersed in making, because that's the equivalent of therapy for me. Mm-hmm. I don't go and sit and talk my problems out anymore. I just get in the studio and make things. And that's turned out to be the perfect balance for me. And so because I'm so inquisitive and I love to make things, I've also been able to build up the stockpile of stuff I know how to do. And that makes me more worth, you know, I'm worth more to my students because I have that wealth of knowledge. So I think the two go hand in hand, really, at least for me.
Now, these days, you've done so many techniques, and the botanical prints that you're doing, these it looks like they're more recent efforts for you. All of this, I guess, surface design is the foundation for all of this. But you have tried all different manner of putting things on a surface. And mm-hmm. Do you focus on one thing, or is it just what can I do if I try this?
When I was at the Craft Center, I recognized that if I wanted to support my daughter as a single mother without child support, if I needed to take care of her and have any sort of stability, that I needed to focus and not be a Jane of all trades. And so that's when I decided that surface design would be the thing that I focused on. And so then I set out to learn how to do as many things as I could learn to do on as many surfaces, frankly. I used to teach a class that was surface design for hard surfaces. And we made lamps and we did tiles and we did all kinds of stuff. So that's led to, in an odd way, it's filled up my toolbox with lots of different things that I know how to do. And I just lost track of what your original question was.
Well, it's just when you focus on a technique, and clearly you don't. It's what can I put on a surface, and you don't care what the surface is.
Well, that's true, but it does happen in units. And so when I was working, for example, on the Inspired by the Masters series, that 2.5 years, I was really focused on the needlework and the process that I had. And before that, complex cloth was my process. And I spent 15, almost 20 years focused on complex cloth as a surface that was dyed and then printed and layered, and how many layers could I get on it, and what different techniques could I use in order to produce beautiful lengths of cloth that would be considered art in and of themselves that wouldn't necessarily ever be cut up. So, and then when I got to botanical printing, I was enamored of botanical printing not long after the Inspired by the Masters series came to a natural conclusion for me. And then I just set out to learn everything I could figure out about botanical printing and how to incorporate what I already knew about surface design, because I couldn't really bring anything new to the botanical printing world, because there are people doing amazing, incredible stuff who got there long before I did. Mm-hmm. But everybody poo-pooed whether typical surface design or traditional surface design techniques had a place in the botanical printing world, because they saw them as unnatural somehow. And so really my goal there was to say, look here, you know, natural dyes are not necessarily any safer than fiber reactive MX dyes. It's all about your process and the precautions that you take. And there are plenty of ways to use gold leaf and paint and watercolor to enhance botanical prints and make them even more beautiful. And if the point is to bring beauty into the world because it makes people happy and it brings them joy, then how can there ever be anything wrong with that?
I watched your introduction to your botanical printing, and what I found intriguing was, and I also, one of your other surface design things is, you would, before you teach it to somebody else, it looks like you spend a lot of time preparing the process.
Mm-hmm. I do.
And I just and experimenting. So the science person in me is like, wow, she's methodical in it. It's just not slapdash. Does
No,
that?
that's absolutely right. And I appreciate your acknowledging that because one of my observations is that too often there's maybe it's the arena that I teach in, but too often instructors are a little cavalier if they don't. If they haven't really worked out details of things, and partly from a safety standpoint, it's always been important to me to know what safety concerns there are and to do that research in advance so I can take care of students. Because I had a student a long time ago who almost poisoned herself, I mean, in a serious way, because she was using bleach improperly and she hadn't really listened to the explanation or the description of how she should be doing it that I gave her. And so I take that very seriously. I think that my students put a certain level of trust in me, and I don't want that to be squandered or be misguided in any way. And so I try to learn every single thing I can. Plus, I hate to be wrong, frankly. Can say I'm wrong, but like Paul Simon said in a song, I think I was wrong back in 1982, and I could be wrong again. So there's a selfish element in all of this,
Oh, that's funny.
When you do these things, like for instance, the collection of botanical prints that you have right now, is an exhibition a goal for you, or is it just to see what you can create?
Well, I think everyone likes to be driven by a deadline. I did not necessarily have the botanical prints in mind as an exhibition, but frankly, I was just to the point in the spring of getting up to speed with the prints to the level that was making me really, really happy because they were distinctive and they were different from anything I'd seen. And that would have been the point at which I would have started to reach out to possible venues for an exhibition. But then COVID came slamming in and just seemed like a we sold a house and bought a house 90 miles away, and we still have a studio that I never spend any time in right now that has all my equipment in it. And so I could be sad about that. I'm terribly sad about how COVID has turned out and all the deaths and the destruction that it's wrought. But I can't personally be sad about the things I had to do to change. And that means that the whole idea of exhibition opportunities went quiet for a while because it seemed much more important to ramp up the online instructing that I was having to switch to because my students could no longer come to my studio in San Antonio and I could no longer go on the road. I lost six jobs over the summer because I couldn't go for the week that it would have been each place and teach. And so that required some, put on your big girl pants and do some fast pedaling and let's see what else can we do here that will not only keep us stable financially, but also reach out to all these other people who were relying on me up to that point for their education and instruction, and let's figure out how we're going to do that in a brand new way as
Right.
fast as we can, really.
Yeah, you're not alone trying to do that. That's for sure. I've thought often recently often, I don't know when, anyway, with some frequency, all of the pent up art, whether it's music, written, needlework, paintings, all of the plays, musicals, all of that has just stopped. And at some point after this pandemic subsides, I just feel like we're going to have an absolute explosion of art as all the artists are freed to once again share what they do.
Yeah, could be a new renaissance. It would be
Yes.
fantastic.
Yeah, one of the six things that were good that came out of this thing, I think.
Right, and I do think, so have you moved to online classes now then?
Well, I yes and no. I had an online class which is ongoing. It's not really a class. I think of it more as a community, which is my creative strength training. And then I also had my mastery program, which is a program that people sign up for a set number of people, 12 people, sign up, and they come to they were coming to San Antonio every 6 months for 2.5 years. And we were in the middle of that program when this all happened. So then I had to take that program online, and now I meet with them every week and I lecture and they work on things and we screen share on Zoom, et cetera. And then I decided that it would probably be a good idea to come up with a lecture series, because there were so many places that I had planned to go to teach, and I saw, you know, it took several months for this to come together, but I saw that I could put together presentations and lectures that weren't ever going to be as good. You know, I did a botanical lecture in December, and it's not as good as coming to Lake Tahoe and studying at Art Quilt Tahoe and taking the class there, but it's not bad. It's not bad. And so I've really turned my creative energy this year into my creative strength training program. And Gary, I have to go back to what you said, because in that program, I have needle people, I have textile people, I have ceramic people, I have surface designers and quilters. Everybody is welcome there. And we had never thought of doing an online exhibition. And yet this year, because of the pandemic, we put out a call that was a member show and anybody could enter. It was not juried. And we got about 80 entries. And my husband is a former art director from McGraw-Hill. So he did this incredible catalog, which is actually on my website in case anybody listening wants to go and look at it. So we had this. And then we did another exhibition at the end of the year for that same group that was specific to archetypes, which is, we don't need to get into that right this minute. But in any event, both those exhibition catalogs are gorgeous. And they're on my website, janedunnewald.com. And if you go there and you look at them, you can see exactly what you were referencing, Gary, that a lot of people have been very fired up and they did incredible, wonderful work. And now we have the benefit of being able to showcase it for anybody around the world who wants to go and look at these exhibitions that we put together. And I'm really proud of that, because I think that's a good example of rising to the occasion and giving people an opportunity to share their work with the public, because they were losing opportunities to show in the same way that I was losing opportunities to show.
Right. Yeah. We're gonna find some pluses. That's one of them, I think, that will come out of this. It's just an unfortunate way to have to get there. It really is. The creative strength training, that's where I got locked in doing research for you. And I'm gonna say this, and it's gonna come out wrong because it's a male and a female world, and I won't say it right, and I'll make people mad. But you know, that won't be the first time. And we've talked about this in some podcasts. I just simply describe it as a lack of confidence that I see in women, and maybe some men, but mainly in women when it comes to needlework, in terms of wanting to be creative, try their own thing, vary from the pattern, stretch a little bit, those kinds of things. And when I started studying that creative strength training and reading what you're doing there, that seemed to really speak to that. Is that part of how you view it? Is that maybe it's not even a thing, and maybe it's just something in my head, but it seems like that creative strength training concept and program really focuses on and helps people drive a willingness and ability, gives them tools to expand their creativity, to reach out when maybe they wouldn't normally have.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's the whole goal.
Okay, well then we're all done then. Okay.
No. Hang on a minute. Because... you know, well, I've got two observations that I think are apropos to, especially to your audience. One is that a lot of us including me, came to the level of wherever we are in creating whatever we create. And in this world, I think it's mainly needlework and textiles, but I know that that's broad. And we have had certain kinds of instruction, but we haven't had the kind of curriculum sometimes, and maybe even when we have, maybe you're right, maybe it is more a female thing, although I don't think so from having had my handful of male students. I think that maybe it's the culture that we live in where we're just sometimes a little shy about making changes, altering a plan, picking different colors, trying something using a technique that's different from what we were taught. Or, you know, Mariska Karatz, if I got her name right, when she came into the embroidery world in the 60s, she completely transformed needlework and embroidery into stitchery, quote unquote. And I think, although I love traditional needle arts, I think it was great for someone like that to come into the needlework world and really stretch what people thought of as good. And that made me realize, and so partly we're dealing with a confidence issue. You're right, that sometimes we are not bold enough and we don't have enough belief in ourselves to venture out and try to put our own spin on what we're making. And so then our satisfaction with what we make sometimes falls short. And creative strength training is meant to help literally strengthen your sense of self as an artist and creative person so that you can take advantage of all the wealth of information that's inside of you to create your own work, which is distinctive and not necessarily, and somebody might get mad at me for this, but so it's no longer completing a kit in the way that I learned to embroider. I learned to embroider by completing kits. And it's so much more satisfying. Maybe that's a great way to learn, but then going beyond the kit into using your stitches or your surface design techniques in order to actualize your own voice, that's where I think it really becomes meaningful and deep. And I think this is the second point. I think one of the reasons that we who are in the textile community have a little bit of trouble with that is because what we do was originated as functional. So there was a good reason the stitches needed to be 12 to the inch in quilting. There was a good reason that white work had to be done a particular way so that people could actually wear the garments. It was a good reason that there were techniques that needed to be perfected because you were putting a lot of darn time and energy into something that somebody was either going to wear or sleep under or fill in the blank, and it needed to be sturdy. But that was in the functional world. And when we start to look at textile techniques and processes as art, then we're no longer in the functional world. And when we're no longer in the functional world, then we don't have to necessarily have 12 stitches to the inch. We can take the stitches all over the place. We can experiment with all kinds of things, as I have, with putting sand on the surface of my fabric and then stitching around it. You know, don't do that. It breaks the needle.
There's your pro tip for the day right there.
Well, I have a friend that's gessoing right now, and I haven't talked to her yet. She's putting gesso on fabric.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, I haven't asked her, how is that going? Are you able to stitch through that? And
no,
I'm curious to hear. The answer is no, huh? Okay.
No. I can tell you that if she buys Fast and Final, which is a spackling product that's actually an acrylic, because I've done 50 pieces with Fast and Final if I've done one, and you can put it all over fabric, and when it dries, it's very elastic, and you can sew through that. And so this is one of the fine-tuning things, and please do pass that on, because there's nothing more fun than putting Fast and Final on a piece of craft felt in a really thin layer with a squeegee. I'm even putting it on my botanical prints, and you can stitch through all of that. I wouldn't sew on a sewing machine through it, but when you're doing handwork, you can do all kinds of stuff. And so that's where it's so good when we can share ideas, because that's where the gesso probably won't work for her because it gets stiff, but then the Fast and Final would work for her. And so that's the importance of having this, which actually cycles back to creative strength training, because that's what the community does. We share ideas like this, and somebody has a way to work something out. And so basically I'm guiding and putting up lectures and tutorials and all that kind of stuff. But then there's this whole community of people who are sharing their techniques and what they know how to do and answering questions. And so I think that's one of the really beautiful things about not working alone and being in community in that way.
Are there common barriers that hold people back when it comes to creativity? I mean, key things that you need to help them get over in these courses?
Yeah, I think that the issues that shut people down are universal. I think we all have a deep creative intelligence. And a lot of the time that is conditioned out of us either deliberately or it's just the, it's just what happens as you grow up. Children all have a deep creative intelligence. And the deep creative intelligence is always in there, so it's just a matter of getting back to it. So one of the things that I talk about in the book, and one of the things that we talk about in the online program, is the fact that we all have inner critics, and I call it the committee. The committee is the people that you either begin to see in your mind's eye or you hear their voices, and they're the ones that say, "Well, we never did it like that before," or, "Well, that's never going to work," or, "I just, you can't make a living as an artist. You better go to secretarial school," that kind of stuff. And so I think everybody, it's just human nature to have those voices inside our head and then to have to learn how to deal with them because they really come back to the self-critic. And then we have to recognize that you're not born into this world believing that you're a failure creatively. That has to be a lesson that you learn somewhere along the way. And so what we have to do is unlearn that lesson. And the best way to do it, in my opinion, is through practice. And practice means going ahead and trying things without desiring an outcome so that you can just get into the groove of returning to your playful child nature. And then we have issues like what happens if you get stuck and you think your creativity is never going to come back. We've got there are ways to deal with that. There are ways to deal with every single boulder that we put in the path of our creativity. And sometimes we don't have the immediate answer, but those are the kinds of answers that I've been accumulating over the years as an instructor for 25 years, so that when I realize someone is encountering one of those roadblocks or stumbling blocks, we have lots of ideas of how to overcome it. Sometimes people get really tight and they just can't loosen up. I one time had a student stand at the window of the third floor of the studio where I was at that point and throw a bag of oranges out the window as hard as she could throw them. And somebody else got up and danced with a broom that had black paint on the end of it on a big piece of white paper. We need to loosen up a little bit in order to remember who we are creatively. And then it starts to flow back naturally. It's almost like, a blood vessel that's gotten stopped up and the doctor goes in and puts in a stent and you're cooking on all four burners again. And your creativity can get shut down like that too. And so there are ways to go in and fix that problem and gradually cultivate that and let it come back in the warmth of the joy that arises when you're creating things that make you happy.
You say something, I've heard you say, or I've read somewhere that you equate this creativity to like exercise, like Gary bikes, I'm a walker jogger. Neither of us would think about going 2 weeks without exercising.
No.
But I would go for a long time without creative play. Could you address that?
Sure. Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think we can't compartmentalize creativity, which we are too easily do. And so maybe I haven't been in the studio since April, but I found myself having more time to cook, so I'm trying recipes and I'm working at this new house in the yard more than I did. And I learned how to do animation so that I could make my presentations more creative. And so I think one of the things that it always helps to stop and evaluate all the different ways that this is actually sort of an assignment. Sit down and evaluate every single way that you are creative in your day-to-day activities and then realize that there are a lot of other creative things going on. Creative intelligence is big and broad. So just because you're not in the studio or stitching doesn't necessarily mean that you're dried up. But if you really have a desire to jumpstart creativity, then find something that is either new to you or manageable and do it for 15 minutes a day in the same way that we build up tolerance or strength training. When we're first biking, Gary, you didn't go out and ride 100 miles the first day you got on the bike.
No.
And So I think that that's why we call it a practice, because it requires practice. And it could be as simple, you know, I have a whole list of things that people can do. But for example, Liz Kettle stitches, and she does for 15 minutes every day. She's a bag of little fabric scraps and thread, and she just stitches, and she makes one little stitched piece every day. Someone else I know does one botanical print in the morning every day, whether she has time to do anything else, because, you know, whatever. You can carve one stamp a day, and at the end of 30 days, you have 30 small 1-inch square stamps that you can use with paint, and all kinds of stuff you can do like that. Expanded square exercise, that's in the Creative Strength Training book, but that really came from a little book that a lot of people know about called Noton, The Light Dark Principle of Design. And that book has a lot of exercises that you could just do one a day for. And here's the thing, I'm really big on not saying I'm going to do this forever. I think it's so much better to navigate the kind of practice that I'm talking about by saying, this is something I want to do for 2 weeks. And at the end of the 2 weeks, if I really enjoy what I'm doing, I'm going to keep going. And if it has worn itself out by then, I'm going to find something else to do for 2 weeks. And set small goals that can be easily accomplished, instead of thinking like, oh, I'm going to journal, I'm going to start journaling. People start journaling and then they fall off after 6 weeks and they feel like failures. And part of the reason, part of the way we could head off feeling like a failure is if we would be wiser about setting a time frame about whatever we want to do and then re-up. So I sign up for magazines, but I don't expect to take the magazine the rest of my life. I'm going to see if I enjoy it. And if I enjoy it, I'll subscribe again. So I think that kind of compartmentalizing, agreeing with yourself that you'll do one thing for a period of time, is a better way to go than feeling that you've rigged yourself up for failure because you weren't really thinking about the consequences of saying you were going to do something indefinitely.
You mentioned in your in some of your writings your three keys to creativity, and you mentioned one of them, the committee, but the others, the rebel and passion. Mm-hmm. How do those three interrelate?
Well, I think that when what we want to do and what we are doing are the same thing, I think this is true about life in general. I also think it's true about what we do when we are being creative. And one of the examples I always give is that I had a student, and Sue was, she was like, she could piece within an inch of her life. She could piece teeny little pieces together to make large quilt tops. She was really good at it. But she was so over it. And she didn't stop doing it because that's what she did best. And whenever she talked about switching to something else, people would say, well, why would you want to do that? You're already so good at what you're doing. And then they'd say, the real clincher, well, you're too old to learn something new.
Ooh.
That's the committee getting out the big guns. That should not be allowed. And so we talked about the fact that she was not in what I call alignment. Alignment is when, even if you're bad at something, if you're enjoying what you're doing, and she wanted to learn to screen print. So she launched a class, really literally for herself, a practice of learning how to screen print. And she wasn't great at the beginning, but 2 years later, she was pretty good. And she was really enjoying it. And so she was, you know, we think of alignment when then we think of a chiropractor, you know, is your back straight? But what we're really talking about in this particular version of alignment is whether the way you spend your time during the day, at least the negotiable time that you have, which is the time when you can choose what you're going to do. We all have non-negotiable time of stuff we have to do. But when we have negotiable time and we spend it doing things that please us or satisfy us or we're learning, then we're in alignment, and then we're happier in the work that we do. And that means sometimes in order to achieve what I'm describing, we have to activate a little rebel energy, and the rebel energy has been tamped down because we live in, let's face it, you know, we're a tribe. We live with other human beings. It's important to socialize and learn to get along, or you have a huge mess on your hands. And so that rebel has been mainly tamped down, but we can pull up a little bit of that rebel energy to realize that life is short and that when we have negotiable time, we should be able to spend it doing whatever we want to do. And sometimes we have to really work to cultivate that rebel, and talking about it with other people who are on that same path of cultivating the rebel and figuring out whether they're in alignment and dealing with the committee, those things are all really related to actualizing a creative life that is bringing you joy and it is also satisfying in lots of different ways.
People that have gone through this creative strength training, read the book, you've interacted with, do you see it changing their lives beyond whatever passion they have, needlework, painting, whatever? Do you see it affecting their regular everyday lives too?
Yeah, I do. I had a student in 2018 from Australia, and she was very creative, great quilt maker, and participated actively. And at the end of the year, she said, "You know, Jane, what I've decided, I've always wanted to go to law school, and I've applied to law school, and I'm starting in January." And she was 62 years old. And she said, "I could never have had the belief in myself to do this if I hadn't worked in creative strength training." Mm-hmm. I know some who got out of a bad marriage, which, you know, there are elephants in the room that we don't like to talk about. But I've had people, that's an example, a woman who screwed up her courage and she got out of a bad marriage. And that was 2 years ago. And she's still with me in the program and she's doing the most sensitive, beautiful work. And it's just such a thrill to see that happen. And I hear stories like that, especially in December when the program kind of, it's the re-upping thing. People always re-up in January. And so in December, it's unusual at all to hear these stories from people who have felt as though it literally changed their lives. Someone wrote to me and she said, "You know, my mother-in-law has bullied me for 30 years. And this year I finally had the courage to say gently to her, 'I really don't like it when you talk to me that way.'" And she said she looked completely shocked and her whole attitude toward me has changed. So this is not therapy at all, but it is harboring or harnessing in inner creative energy. And when we start with our artwork and we start feeling more more capable in that realm, it can't help but start to ripple out into the rest of our lives. I mean, it's completely changed my life. And so I'm living proof, having risen out of a bankruptcy and a divorce, you know, in 1980, about that same time I was at the Kraft Center. And the hard lessons that come from life experience, everybody gets kicked to the curb occasionally. And when we have our creative intelligence to support us and we have the beauty of whatever we're making and the fulfillment of that creative process to cling to, in addition to the people who love us, it can really be a life raft that we need. And so I see it as a sacred act, really, working with people in the way that I try to work, which might sound hokey or phony to some people, but I realize how powerful it can be. To be an artist is a huge, huge privilege.
And I love your mantra, your bullet point mantra. Is that something you just put together, picked up from someone else? What is it? Stay in the present time, seek only the truth, surrender your will to God. Love is the only real power. Honor thyself, honor one another, and all is one. Where'd that come from?
Well, I'm a fan of Caroline Mace. Her last name is spelled M-Y-S-S. And in 2002, she wrote a book called Sacred Contracts. And I happened to read that book the year she wrote it. And I have followed what she has written ever since. And she is not specifically interested in creativity at all. She's a modern day human theorist, but she wrote a book that had each chapter was basically the mantra that you just spoke out loud. Each of those lines was the summation of a chapter in a book that she wrote. Mm. And so that was what I distilled what she had written into for myself, because it began to take the, it didn't replace prayer, but it began to play an important role in centering and beginning my studio day and beginning my teaching day, et cetera. Because when you remember those 7 points, you, all I can say is that it led me to become a more compassionate person in an overall sense. And I don't think compassion is ever wasted in the classroom.
And you have, it's interesting when I see that. And then obviously religion, part of your foundation, but then also your list of books that have changed your life. You really have you really operate from a foundation of deep thought and analysis, I guess, of where you're at and how you're, where you're headed.
I do. I think there have been any number of wisdom masters in the world before me. And I guess it's just, you know, I know in the past, my college roommate, we're still really close friends. She said, "Do you realize how intense you are? You scare people." and so I've tried to tone that down, but you know, I take all of this really seriously because I see how it can change lives. And I did not come to the place where I am today without a lot of self, without a lot of work and reflection. And I don't ever expect other people to want to focus on things in quite the same way that I do, but I know it's the best strategy for me personally. And then if I can turn that into something that I can give back, I try to.
Well, it's yeah, it comes through in all of your writings and just throughout your website. It's neat to see. It really is. Yeah. The creativity, your personal creativity, is that, are you one of those that has a mental list of things you can't wait to try as soon as you get a spare minute, or is that something that doesn't come as easily to you?
Oh no, I try to be sympathetic when people just can't get ideas. I think that's just like something's been slightly turned off and there's a way to turn that back on, but that has never been my problem. I wake up and I always have way more ideas than I'm ever going to be able to accomplish. Right now, I'm afraid that I have more ideas than I can accomplish in my lifetime. And we sit in the morning, our routine is to sit, my husband and I, and for about 45 minutes and drink a cup of coffee. I drink hot lemon water and we talk about the day. And sometimes he looks at me and says, "I'm already exhausted." you know, I don't care. Caroline Mace said it best. She said, you know, this is her personally, and so this is only me personally. I don't really see any reason to pamper myself or try and take it easy, because I would rather reach the finish line totally worn out and exhausted. And so that's just my strategy. We just work, and it's all fun. So, you know, what is Sunday? What is Saturday? There isn't really a weekend in my life, but it doesn't matter, because everything we're doing, except for my granddaughter comes now once a week in the morning, and that's my church. And the rest of the time, we're projects. We love projects and we're working on things all the time. And that's just great. I can hardly wait to share what I come up with other people, and they seem to be responding. And so it's a beautiful circle.
Sounds like you're having a great time with life. That's wonderful. Yep.
Well, it's tragic and it's terrible. And we've lost people. I personally have lost people to COVID. I just heard about another one this morning. My mother's 90 years old and health challenged. And so these are the stages of life that are just brutal to deal with. And yet, Khalil Gibran said, "Your joy is your sorrow unmasked." And I think every day we're all facing some amount of joy and some amount of sorrow. And we just have to get up each day and say a prayer, say the mantra, and see where it goes and stay in present time. And so, you know, I'm really not very philosophical in deep ways, but that's the best approach I've got.
Jane, A real treat to talk with you. Thanks so much. We were anxious to have this conversation, and really a special hour. Thank you very much.
Oh, Gary.
Yeah, thank you, Jane.
It was delightful to talk to both of you. Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
All right. And thanks to everybody for listening.